Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up the world, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. I'm your host, and this is MJ Network. MJ stands for Marcia Joyce, my sister, who I named this after, and I miss her every day. This is going to be totally fantastic. This is a true crime story about Gerald and Alice Uden. And when you meet them in this book, you're going to want to read it. Basically, you're going to be glad that where they are right now. A story that has been told, but the final ending remains unknown. And the one person that knows the truth about everything refuses to tell. Well, let's introduce Ron Francell, and we're going to talk about Alice and Gerald. Hi, good morning. How are you? I'm glad you're here.
Good morning, Fran. I'm glad to be here, and thanks for making time for me. It's a privilege.
Thank you. So how come you decided, I mean, a lot of people investigate true crime and murder. Why did you decide to investigate this murder and then spotlight it on your book? As a matter of fact, the book was a surprise. It came in the mail, and I go like, what? And your publicist sent it. And her email kicks back is unavailable, by the way. So too bad she doesn't know.
First of all, I guess let me start by saying that the secret of my success as a writer has been that I never pick a story that I can screw up. Alice and Gerald is, struck me as one of those kinds of stories. It's the power of this very human story about universal stuff, you know, love and persistence and devotion and, of course, murder. And all those things are really bigger than my storytelling. I was really attracted to this cast of characters. We have this homicidal husband and wife. We have a series of dogged detectives who pursue this case over about four decades. And then we have this grieving grandmother who won't let the memories or the search, for that matter, die. So on one level, it's an American crime story. On another, it's sort of a Shakespearean tragedy. And that just attracted me.
Yeah, it is. It's different. And when I got it in the mail, I was like, I looked at the book and I'm going like, why am I reading this? Who sent it? And then once I started, I was like, because a lot that happens a lot, like yesterday, the day before, and they don't email me and say, would you like to read it? They just send it and say, by the way, we're sending it. I go, well, you're too late. I already have it. I'm like, excuse me. So what about this murder do you think people need to know about? And was it because it ran cold for so many years? That is so scary. It's bone chilling to think that they almost got away with this. That would have been horrible.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
I think Alice and Gerald is really a book about this series of cops who chase these ghosts over nearly four decades. It's about six men and women and a whole cast of supporting characters, of course. But they are looking for justice for the families of these four people, maybe five, as the book reveals. It's also about this ripple effect of evil. In it, we're seeing the bad side of human behavior, and that's a staple of true crime, of course. But we also get a hint of this more resilient side. That's not a staple of true crime these days. And that's Claire Martin, that grandmother that I referred to. Her hope never really dies. It falters there toward the end, but it doesn't die. And I think what I want people to know about is the persistence of the good guys in this story. Mm-hmm. You know, think about it this way. Think about it this way. You're dead, or a loved one is dead. You're murdered. Your killer was smart enough to hide your corpse in a secret place where it can't probably never be found. Your family and your friends wonder what happened, but they sort of hope that you've just wandered away and started a new life. And in this case, without a body, without even the tiniest shred of evidence, these, you know, detectives anywhere, they have to move on. They've got other cases. They're warmer cases. They can be solved today. So when they move on, you have just become a cold case. Now, each of us wants to feel like our existence mattered. Mm-hmm. We want to believe we're going to be missed. And so we hope there's going to be somebody who won't forget. And if you're luckier in your death than you were in your life, one of those passionate, maybe even obsessed detectives will take your case, and they'll pursue it long after people, their sheriff, their captain, their spouse, their friends have told them to drop it. And if they believe in justice, if they believe in you, that's all we can hope for. And so that's what I want people to take away.
Well, I took a lot away, which you read my review. I took plenty away. I felt bad for the police that were so frustrated. I felt bad every time they wanted to come and do some, you know, search to see where the people were. And it felt terrible because it cost so much money to get anything done. And they were up against a whole bunch of roadblocks. But tell us about Gerald before he met. He had a couple of wives before he met Alice. And he was strange, but why didn't he realize that she was crazy? Seriously.
Gerald sees himself as John Wayne. He thinks he's heroic, and he's cunning, and he's powerful, and you know, in reality, he's just this Midwestern farm kid. He's not that smart. He was a maintenance man at a mine in Wyoming. He made enough to pay for the stuff that he wanted and needed. That was mostly guns and rent for his trailer. He didn't drink. He didn't have too many friends. He wanted a wife and a family. So he was married 3 times before he met Alice. They were all very torrid and fast marriages. After each divorce or breakup, usually after only a short time, he got more eager to please the next one. So it was only a matter of time before he met somebody like Alice. And she was tuned into his neediness. And she used it. She used it to the hilt. To him, she was the most beautiful woman he'd ever seen. They fell into bed very quickly, and she was better than any woman he'd ever been with, according to him.
Yeah, to him and his eyes.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, she had it all. She was a total package. She liked meat. She liked guns. She liked fishing. He needed to have her. And so he became so desperate for this fourth marriage to succeed, he would do anything. And that goes to your question about why didn't he see her? Well, she was very complex. She's a narcissistic sociopath who needs to control everything. I started to see her as Lady Macbeth.
Yeah, even worse.
She knew no boundaries, and she I think was so good at that that it would that it was hard for Gerald to see that, this sort of country doofus who was blinded by his own lust. I think it was difficult for him to see it.
I don't think he still sees it. That's the scary part.
I don't. I think you're right. I think you're absolutely correct.
I don't think
correct.
He does. Yeah, I don't think so. After reading the rest of the book, I was like, holy God, Gerald, snap out of it. We need to smack you in the face. Seriously.
Yeah,
so,
really.
So he actually, it's almost as if, I'm just writing notes as I'm listening, it's almost as if she had like a roadmap, and then she outlined what he has to do every single day, and if he didn't do it, God forbid, that's how it seemed. Like, this is what
yes,
you're going to do every
I
day,
think,
Gerald, yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly true, that she controlled everything. Now,
yeah.
Occasionally, she let him think he was controlling it.
There are
examples of that, but they're usually small and they're usually unimportant.
So tell us about her kids, Ted and Liza, and did they like Gerald? I mean, I would be afraid of her.
Well,
I would be afraid just to go near her. She's crazy.
To a certain degree, they were too. She had five kids. And they ranged, at the time of when this story starts with Gerald, they ranged from toddlers to teenagers. A couple of them were already out of the house. She took these little jobs. They were usually short. She liked driving a school bus for rancher kids to this remote one-room school, or bartending in a roadside dive in the middle of nowhere. She was trained as a practical nurse, so she'd take occasional jobs in hospitals or in clinics and that sort of thing, but they never lasted long, and she moved around very quickly. And, you know, she too had three husbands and probably a lot more lovers before she met Gerald. So the kids became expensive and a little hard to deal with. So they were often sent back to family in the East. And then she'd get on her feet again and bring one or two of them back. And then she'd have another lover or another husband and send them back. And it was this back and forth. There was, I don't think, ever a time when all of her, well, three of the five, I don't think there was ever a time when those three were actually with her. Now, that goes on into their growing up years.
Yeah.
And she does some things that even surprise me as a veteran crime writer.
Mm-hmm.
For example, she... her 12-year-old son, Ted, one of his jobs when he's 12, and again, seventh grader, one of his jobs is to drive her to the little roadhouse where she worked as a bartender, which was 30 miles away in the middle of nowhere from Laramie, Wyoming, and then to wait until her shift was over. And
oh my God.
She would come out, come back to the car, usually with a six-pack of beer that she took from the cooler. And then his job was to drive her home. Now, we're talking about the wee hours of night now. They would share the six-pack on the drive home. It's during one of those trips that she tells him how she killed one of her earlier husbands because he was abusive. And it simply shakes this little kid up. And as the book relates, it sticks with him for a long time. It sticks with him in a very scary way.
I would imagine it would scare anybody to think that your mother is so crazy that she killed somebody. But after learning why she did it, she might have gotten away with it for the reason. because she was so, she justified her actions. She actually believed that what she was doing was right. Plus, I can't believe that the schools didn't want to find out what happened to the kids. I mean, she's crazy, but she was good at it.
She was crazy, but she was a narcissist. She was
a
narcissistic sociopath, and one of the elements of her character is she needs to tell somebody what she did. Now, remember that she probably knew she didn't kill this guy because he was abusive. She needed to tell somebody. Well, it's her 12-year-old son at this point, and he takes it as a shot across the bow. He kind of sees it as a warning. This will happen to you if you talk.
Yeah. That is something. I'm surprised that he didn't do something to kill her or that he didn't need mental help. I mean, any child 12 years old like that would be disturbed. He's got to be crazy.
He was disturbed. It's just that come out. It didn't come out.
I'm surprised he didn't leave. Scary. So she had Eliza, too, and she lied at times for her mother's actions, too. They were all so afraid of her. Nobody ever told the truth. They all covered for her, even her.
Yes.
And she was afraid of her, too.
It's their mother. It's their mother, and in the case of her mother, it's her daughter. And these are people living on the margins anyway. They don't always trust the authorities. So the idea that they would choose to protect their mother, as flawed as she was, is not a big stretch for us to believe.
Well, let me get to the case. So how did this come to the attention of anybody? There's a role of a profiler, Walter. And explain the research you did into the procedures. Did you interview this person and consultants to help you to write this? Because it's definitely accurate, because I read every single article that's on the internet about this. Seriously, I read them all. That's how come I came up with all those questions.
Well, I appreciate that. First of all, it goes back to the fact that this happens in a place that I know like the back of my hand. And I saw a chance to tell this deep story. This is a very complex story that is not typical for true crime today. It's got literary elements, but I hope it doesn't put off the ordinary true crime reader. So, because I lived there, but first, the setting, while not easy, I understood it. I lived it. I lived there at the time when these crimes were happening. Of course, nobody knew about them at the time, but I was working construction jobs and in the oil fields. And I was working with the kinds of people and the kinds of places that I describe. So I know the landscape and I know the mindscape intimately. And I wanted to bring it to life because there are a lot of readers out there who think Wyoming is a foreign country anyway.
That's true.
Might as well be a crater on the surface of the moon. So I, being an old school journalist, I believe truly, madly, and deeply that I have to be there. So I stood in the places I describe. I stood in the murder scenes. I stood in the grandmother's laundry. I stood at one of the mines where the bones of horses, cows, and dogs still lay around. I smelled it, I listened to it, I touched it. Basically, I just looked for that narrative dust that tends to settle on everything in cases like this. It's this textual grit that kind of makes it real. So that leads me then through the story. I know what's happening out there. I've interviewed investigators. I've seen the documents. I had unprecedented access to the case file, a 40-year case file. You bring up Richard Walter. He's one of the world's leading forensic psychologists. He worked at the Michigan State Prison. He interviewed countless killers. He was a co-founder of what's known as the VDOC Society, which is this monthly luncheon in Philadelphia where some of America's best crime-fighting people and minds get together for lunch to help ordinary cops solve some of their cold cases. So Walter is an expert himself on sadism and human sexual cannibalism. And he studied Alice and Gerald's case to help some of the later detectives get a handle on it and to connect some of those unconnected dots. He knew what drove Alice and Gerald, but he taught these cops to see the story of Alice and Gerald in a way that would help them solve the case and to a certain degree talk about it. And Walter is a fascinating guy. He's one of the few people with whom I can speak bluntly and as colorfully as I want about the most grotesque things. And honestly, a crime writer loves those kind of people because we live among people for whom this stuff is kind of scary. So when we find people where we can talk about it without restrictions, it's a wonderful find.
You're lucky because a lot of people don't have the consultants or the people to talk to. I mean,
everyone writes something.
It makes it hard. You're lucky because I wrote something in one of my Faces Behind the Stone series, and I wanted help from the fire department here. They told me to call, but you know what? They weren't as forthcoming as helping me write something, so I wound up having to go on the Internet to find out what I needed to know. So you have to be lucky.
You do. You have to be lucky. You have to know the questions.
Yeah.
You have to know how they work.
Yeah, I know.
It's a journalist's problem. A journalist has that difficulty that you experienced. And I have, throughout my career, had that difficulty. Somehow, calling as a book author and a crime writer opens doors a little bit more. But again, we're going back to Wyoming, where I lived and where I know people. So I talk to a lot of those people. I talk to the investigators, of course. I did 150 plus interviews. And I think that I tend to ask startlingly stupid questions, but they pay off for me. But I talk to experts in Western mining, in underwater robotics, in forensic pathology, of course, in embalming, in human decomposition, old skeletons, how rust works. So you find these people, and they're usually willing to talk to you as long as you show some interest or understanding of what they do. If you're going in, and it is, and I think that has been the thing for me that opens the most doors.
Yeah, I did ask them because they had to come here for something else, and the guy was really nice. I guess maybe his fire chief didn't want to have the time to sit down. I had the right questions too, because I usually ask very in-depth questions that people don't want to answer. What can I say? So this is the most exciting part. I'm reading this book, and of course, those of you that didn't read it, you could see the pictures of Alice and Gerald. Just looking at her is enough to scare you, even though she's where she is right now. Seriously, that face is enough to woo. So how did you get to talk to him in person? Well, I imagine you talked to him through phones. Were you exactly in the same room with this person?
We never spoke on the phone.
No,
you
spoke in person?
Yes, and my first contact with him was through letters. I wrote to him. I told him what my interest was, and he at first refused. He didn't want to participate, and Alice really didn't want to participate. But I persisted, and I wrote more letters, and I explained to him that this was his chance to tell his side of the story.
Okay.
Because if he didn't, who would tell his story? Well, it was going to be prosecutors. It was going to be investigators. It was going to be his workmates who didn't think much of him, and he knew it. So I think that appealed to it, and he started then to write about more of it. And we kind of slowly worked our way up. Ultimately, I think he was eager to please me. He answered all my questions. This was a correspondence that lasts, well, it actually continues today. Without the questioning, but it lasted about 3 years. I think that he was eager to please me. He appeared to be candid. I'm aware that whenever I deal with these kind of people, particularly in prison, that I'm being played. So I
would think so.
These are sociopathic people. They don't do anything that doesn't help them in some way. At one point then I just asked, can we meet in person and continue our interviews? And he agreed to that. So I traveled up to Wyoming and met him. We did 3 days worth of interviews, full days. He struck me as not playing me. Maybe wasn't smart enough to play me, and he would sing songs to me. He would recite poetry, and he was friendly. He was open. I had questioned his candor, but I could confirm all the things, or maybe already had confirmed all the things that he was telling me. So while I never really abandoned my skepticism about him, he loosened up and I loosened up. What was strange about the in-person interviews were that he would talk like your strange uncle who never tells a funny joke. But he tries. That doesn't keep him from trying. He was friendly. He was almost affectionate. There would always come a time when he was describing his crimes, specifically describing his crimes, how he disposed of bodies and that sort of thing. A veil would sort of come down. And he became distant, he became disconnected, he became cold, and I that bothered me. It continues to bother me, I think ultimately, yes, Gerald got accustomed to the granular nature of my questions. I was really going deep. I mean, at one point I asked him, what were you listening to on your truck radio as you were driving these bodies to a remote dump site?
Oh, God.
I asked him blood on his clothes. I asked him about stink on his clothes from these decomposing bodies that he had to wrestle around. He had to be holding them and touching them to do what he said he had done. So you can see that I'm asking questions that go deep, and into great detail. And because he had come to trust me after a while, he would answer these questions, sometimes bluntly. I asked him at one point if when he came home that night they made love. And most people would say, go to hell and get out. It's none of your business. He just said, oh, we would have normally, but I was so tired we didn't.
So, that's scary.
It is scary.
I know, because she said to him, if you don't take care of those two kids and Virginia, I'm going to divorce you. So she really manipulated him. Where in his right mind would you do that? I mean, seriously. People can't wait to read it, because nobody really knows the end of the story, because there is no, basically, end of the story. That's what's scary.
Well, that's true. I think that the pressure Alice put on Gerald to achieve her own comfort. She didn't like having any of his ex-wives around, and yet they all were around. She had a money motive. She didn't like that he was paying child support for these two little boys, or alimony to his third ex-wife. And when that third ex-wife began to make noise about getting more money, Alice just shifted over into that sociopathic mindset, where she was going to use Gerald to achieve her ends. And as you say, she said, if you don't take care of it, I'm out of here. And he is so crazy blind about keeping this woman that he does that.
He's blindsided and like nearsighted and no-sighted. He had no idea.
No-sighted.
I mean, seriously, that it's almost as if a fatal attraction. That's scary, really.
Yes, exactly.
And the sad part is, and she's still doing it, isn't she, from prison? She's still doing the same thing.
Well, I think she is. I was talking to some prison authorities. She's in the prison's geriatric facility. She's in her late 70s. But she is manipulating them. She manipulated me by simply not doing what I wanted her to do. She's sick. But she's sick in that kind of scary way that nobody can tell she's sick. She and Gerald, for all their crimes, eluded arrest for almost 40 years.
Yeah.
Because Alice was sort of toxically bold, and Gerald was following her lead like a puppy. There were never enough dots to connect in those long investigations over a long time and many agencies and many detectives, and so they couldn't arrest them. They kind of suspected them, but they couldn't arrest them. So Alice is smart and lucky, and she had Gerald as a sort of hostage to her plans.
The sad part is, Claire Martin, I felt so bad for her. Because she was paying for a lot of this for them to find out. Because they were telling her, that she was away, and then she sent her the phony information to think that Virginia was really, you know, someplace else, but she really wasn't. And she sort of fell for it. I mean, poor Claire. And that's the sad part about it. She was 92 years old, and she never had closure. I mean, what kind of an evil person does that? Alice does that.
Well, Alice.
Yeah,
it's a narcissistic sociopath does that.
Yeah, she's
Richard
nuts.
Walter,
I mean,
she is. And Richard Walter, who we talked about a little earlier, called her a scorpion. And I think that's a good description of her. Claire Martin is quite the opposite, of course. She kept up maximum pressure on the cops for more than 30
yeah.
years. She spent all of her money on this search and on her hope that they were just out there someplace. She even kept the car they disappeared in just in case, you know, some future science would come up with a way to find other clues in it. So she bounced back and forth about dead or missing or simply escaped. She mostly came down in wanting to believe that they simply escaped. At times she was certain that Virginia had just vanished. And then other times she believed Virginia was dead. But until the end, she believed with all her heart that her two grandsons were still alive. She hunted for them in extraordinary and creative ways. This is before the internet. So she was sending letters and making phone calls and doing thousands, tens of thousands of flyers on a Xerox machine down at the post office and tacking them to telephone poles. She did all of this herself. So later, by the time the internet could have helped her, she's too old to use it. Although she tried. She just couldn't navigate it. She died. She was, like you say, she died in a nursing home. And by then, she'd occasionally talk about him in the past tense, but it was rare. And she still hoped. I was given by an investigator a letter, a very poignant letter that she'd written to her grandsons. In those later years, and it was to be opened only upon their return or confirmation of their dying. Just in case, she bought them a grave plot in a small town, and she asked that some of her ashes be buried ultimately with them if they were ever found.
I don't think that's ever going to happen. That is the saddest part.
Hasn't happened yet.
I know. That's what got me at the end. And like that, I don't know if she knows where they are or he knows. I'm just wondering that they originally put them somewhere. And you have the detective that I love the most is T. Best and Tina Trimble. And they're the ones that really, and Woodson, seriously, they didn't give up no matter what. And if it were up to them, they still would not give up that what happened. So how does somebody so cruel, and I bet it has to do with Alice, it can't possibly just Gerald, she must be telling him, he has to know where the bodies are. He's just not saying, and I can't understand why it would matter. I mean, Virginia's gone, so Alice doesn't want her to have a final resting place because she dared to want her children taken care of. That's scary.
Yes.
I got that, didn't I?
yes, you did. And I think that, of course, Lonnie Tabiste and Tina Trimble, the last two detectives to work on this, they were those people that I talked about earlier. They were the people who were blessed and, I think, cursed with this obsession. I think they believed in Claire. They believed in Virginia and the boys. I think that what you're seeing there is that obsession that we talked about. Tina was a former, actually Tina and Lonnie and Woodson were former street cops. They brought this investigative spirit, not the political that some of Lonnie Tabiste's earlier bosses had. They brought this devotion to the idea that we solve crimes here, we investigate crimes here. So by the time Woodson becomes the director of this state investigative agency, Things have kind of gone cold. Tabiste has retired. Tina is working her way up as just the second female investigator in this state agency. And Woodson comes in and immediately redirects people to put an emphasis on investigation and to create a cold case squad, which Tina was the new director of this cold case squad. So the way I've described it is that starting in the early 80s, you have the first investigator, and he takes the ball 10 yards down the field, and then along comes another investigator, and then another and another until they've moved this ball closer to the goal line. It's really an extraordinary look at how these things can last for 30 or 40 years, but it requires people with that blessing or that curse to get justice. And at several times in this case, we see and we believe, I believed, and I wanted the reader to believe, this case could stop right now. This case could end right now because something has happened to drop it. And I think that's one of the things that readers will take away is this kind of suspense, whether this thing is actually going to go the distance or not.
Well, before I forget, Tuesday, at a special time, 12 p.m., Robert DeGoni, the Eighth Sister. On the 15th, another special time, 1 p.m., George Putnam and Jewel Grutman, Redfish Oak. It's a true story about the Plains Indians. On the 17th, another true story, Dylan Volk will be talking about his life with Asperger's Spectrum Syndrome. On the 23rd, my favorite person in the whole world, John Land, will be there for Strong to Steal. On the 25th, David Burnsworth caught up in it. And on the 29th, something different. Trinity House Entertainment .inc will focus on their new song, Blood, I Love You, and their inspirational music. And what a nice way to end April. It'll be really fun. So, Alice and Gerald get finally what they deserve. So what was her reaction to them? They finally caught him. And what did he say? He said to the judge, explained that he could afford the child support. We had money, but he wasn't going to pay it because Virginia was intolerable. So he tried to justify his actions to the judge, and the judge like, are you serious? Not really.
Well, I think she said that to some of the investigators because by the time she goes to trial, they have separated the two of them, and Gerald goes his way in one courtroom, a distant courtroom, and Alice goes her way, and the rules of the trial forbid them from talking about Gerald and Gerald's crimes. They are only talking about Alice and Alice's crimes. So there's never any reference at all to Virginia. What's interesting, and I talked to jurors in this case, what's interesting is that you have, at the time these crimes are being committed, you have a robust, lively, doable woman who's committing the crimes, who's killing people. By the time she goes to trial, she's a 70-something little grandmother, and she's playing that to a certain degree. She comes in only in a wheelchair. She has to wear a hearing device that really she didn't need. She projects that she's this seriously ill woman. So jurors were faced with a little grandmother. They were faced with convicting a little grandmother of murder. They actually had to kind of rethink that. They had just kind of slapped themselves and say, no, she wasn't a grandmother. She was this very much alive, very young, very passionate kind of woman that isn't this person sitting in front of us. So that was another element of her trial. But yeah, I mean, once they pierced her lies and her manipulations, she seemed to be candid about things, but in fact, she wasn't. She's an expert liar. And it's simply at every moment when you think you have a breakthrough with her, she's lying again. Mm-hmm. And then you have another breakthrough and she lies some more, and so on until you go to trial.
Well, she's not even getting the bad treatment. She's in the geriatric part, so she's not even in. Like, I'm surprised that they didn't, well, they figure maybe if they don't give her a death penalty or really death row or something, maybe eventually one of them will tell where the bodies are, but don't bet on it. That's what's really scary.
That's an interesting point you make. I had developed a relationship with Gerald, and over the two or three years that we corresponded, he often, maybe every couple of letters, would express that he regretted that all this happened because he would never see Alice again, and it was the driving force with him.
Mm-hmm.
When we did our face-to-face interviews, he made similar comments. So with the blessing of the authorities, who thought that maybe my relationship with him was better, I proposed to Gerald that if he would tell us where the bodies really were, and it could be proven, that I would make the argument to the authorities that he should be allowed to see Alice one more time.
I remember
time.
That.
Now,
I allowed that.
Imagine
yeah.
these two people. Well, at least Gerald loves Alice. And desperately wants to see her, but they lay their heads down every night, maybe 20 yards apart, but separated by a couple of concrete walls, and they will never see each other. So when I made this proposal to Gerald, he kind of shrugged and said, no, I told you where they are. I don't have anything to deal with. Richard Walter, the psychologist, and he said, no, the bodies aren't where he says. They're someplace else, and he knows. But he fears disappointing Alice more than he wants to see Alice.
That's
and he
right.
wants to see her badly. So
that's not gonna
that
happen.
Was an element of this that again illustrated the hold that she had over him.
It's so sad because he's justifying what he's doing in his own head because he wants to please Alice and never considering the fact that there's a lady that died and you took away her two grandchildren and her daughter and she had no closure. So just as a human being, as a person, which he's not because he's more afraid of her, and basically I would think that Alice had poor self-esteem in her own way because this is her way of getting people, her children and everybody, just to do whatever she said. And that's
exactly.
frightening. That's scary.
Well,
so
he
resigned himself to his fate. And he doesn't sound like he's having a really bad time in jail for what he did.
No, he is
not.
He's in a medium security prison. He resigned himself to his crime only to protect Alice. His confession was that he had purely done this of his own accord and Alice had absolutely no involvement. Today, during my interviews, he allowed as how maybe Alice was more involved than he had said. But now she's in prison, so there wasn't anything more to protect. I think Gerald is a sociopath on his own. I don't think he's this dumb galoot, because he killed people and he did it coldly. When he expresses remorse to me, it's mostly that he got caught. Somebody kept, you know, couldn't keep their mouth shut, and that led to his arrest. But he's a sociopath too. He's not just a galoot. But he is under the sway of a worse sociopath.
What would happen, seriously, if he told where the bodies were and they didn't say that he told them, that somebody actually found it? I can't believe that eventually he claimed that he killed Virginia Baba and her son and dumped them in a 450-foot deep Fremont Lake.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not there. They're not there. So he also said, I knew that if I killed one, I would have to kill all of them. And I have no excuse. That's what he told the judge. And he showed absolutely, I mean, I just read it was bone-chilling, that he had no excuse. He said, if I were younger, what would have happened if they actually caught him before? In other words, not when he's in his 70s, maybe when he's in his 50s or whatever. Wouldn't they have given him a tougher sentence or worse, because he deserved
it? Yeah, I think so. I think so. I think the fact confessed, I think part of his confession was to take the death penalty off the table. Of course,
he's doing it too.
To protect Dallas, but I think they made the deal to take the death penalty off the table. And in Alice's case, she was ultimately convicted of second-degree murder, so it was not on the table. Either way, they're both in their upper 70s and have life without parole. So they probably would, as younger people, probably live longer during their appeals of their death sentences than they will as elderly people just serving out their time.
That is so sad. And when the sad part is that the state of Wyoming or wherever they are they're paying for that. The people
are paying
for them to be kept alive. And I guess they're still hoping that if they keep them alive, that maybe the day he dies or before, and it's not going to happen, that he's going to ever tell. That's so sad for those poor children. I mean, I read that scene where he just killed her and then killed the two of them. Like, it was nothing.
Yes.
Like, okay, you're expendable. You're costing me money. What the heck? That's so sad.
Yes, and his intent was to kill Virginia. The fact that the two little boys were there, they were witnesses. So he felt he had no other choice. He had to kill the witnesses too. Now think about this. This is a woman who said she loved you once, who slept with you. These are little boys that called you daddy. Think about the coldness it takes.
That's so sad. So we have about 5 minutes. The original investigators, are they still investigating this case, or are they just giving up? Because it's
so
sad.
I mean,
it bothers me.
That was part of it, that the very first investigator ultimately ran for sheriff and became sheriff in his little town. And so he couldn't do it anymore. And that's the first time it might drop into and just be dead. The next guy that takes it becomes a sheriff and then has some problems outside of this investigation. He's removed from office. That's the second time we think this will die. The next investigator to pick it up, there's a couple more in there in between, but finally Lonnie Tabiste takes it, and he faces political problems in the state agency where he works, and they understand his passion for this case, so they use it against him. He retires under that duress, and then it's a few more years before Tina Trimble and her cold case task force pick it up and continue continue the investigation. That span is about 40 years.
God,
so
help us.
That it's amazing, but no, nobody is still working this case.
It just seems so unfair because they're sitting in prison. The state of Wyoming and the taxpayers are paying for them to be alive, and he's going to stick to his story, and those poor children are someplace, their bones are crumbled somewhere, but you don't know where. So what are your goals for your next book, and where can everybody buy this book? Because I think everybody needs to read it, and it's so sad because it must be even more painful for Behest and Trimble and all of them that they can't, you know, get closure, for the, at least for Claire, at least for that.
Yeah, well, and there's nobody still alive beyond the investigators who
I know.
For whom this is important. But they've put the bad guys away, and so while there's interest in finding those, they've already spent a lot of money to try to find them. And it's been a years-long proposition, and they just simply haven't been able to. So barring evidence, new evidence that comes up, they're probably not going to mount another full-scale search. Goals for the next book? Well, I'm working on it already. It's in the same mold as Alice and Gerald. It's not an ordinary tale of murder. Again, it was a chance to write about a time and a place I understand, and more importantly, to explore those same kinds of human issues. In this particular case, our capacity for fooling ourselves and not realizing that we're on the very edge of our future and of the world's future. This is a story it's a historic tale that nobody's ever told. And it ends with, well, no, it doesn't. It tells the story of a sea change in criminology, a sea change in how we look for bad guys. So, I do everything that a good writer wants to do. I want to move you. I want to educate you. I want to entertain you. It's really the bargain I make when you buy my book. And where
well,
can
I have
buy
good
it?
News
well,
for you.
Any bookstore.
I will tell you right now that there is somebody that has another show. It's a good story. It's a good story with Marcia Casper Cook. She's been listening to the whole show. She's on the line right now. And she would like, I'm going to put you in an email with her. She would like you to send her the book, and she's going to read it, and you should be honored because she's going to read your book, and she would like to have you on her show.
Oh, that'd be terrific.
Yeah, she is terrific, and she likes to chat, and for you, she's actually going to read the book. I'm excited because this is something that she needs. Yeah, so I want to thank you so much, and I hope you send me the next one whenever it's ready. Because I'll definitely do this again. This was really exciting. I even told my pharmacist when I had to ask her questions, she says, I want to know what happened. I mean, there are a lot of people. I just made the show go live. I'll send you the link. Everybody is excited. This book really needs to be out there, and people need to know. And the sad part is if you speak to Gerald again or if you email him or talk to him or whatever, maybe you can play his conscience. Maybe he doesn't have to tell Alice. Maybe he's just disappointing himself by not telling what happened.
We've tried all the angles. Knowing his psychology, we've tried a
That's
lot
so
of the
sad.
Angles.
It's never going to happen. It's not fair to the children. These are his children. I mean, you know, I know he adopted them, but it's still, these are children that adored you and love you, and you betrayed them. That's what the sad
That's
part is.
Part of the tragedy. Part of the tragedy, part of the Shakespeare in this. It's not just an ordinary true crime story.
I know. Well, I want to thank you so much. This has been really interesting. I want everybody
to
have a great day. Thank you so much, everyone. Have a great day, and bye.
Bye-bye.